Hello and welcome to our reading of Associated Press News for Friday, the 10th of April. My name is Al Freeman. Our first AP headline, soaring gas prices lead to biggest monthly inflation spike in 4 years. The story written by Christopher Rugeber and Dateline Washington. The largest monthly jump in gas prices in 6 decades caused a sharp spike in inflation in March, creating major challenges for the inflation fighters at the Federal Reserve and heightening the political hurdles for the White House. Consumer prices rose 3.3% in March from a year earlier, the Labor Department said Friday, up sharply from just 2.4% in February and the biggest yearly increase since May 2024. On a monthly basis, prices rose 0.9% in March from February, the largest such increase in nearly 4 years. It's the first read on inflation to capture the effects of the Iran war. The spike in gas prices will stretch the budgets of many lower and middle-income households as it erodes their incomes, making it harder to afford other necessities such as food and rent. Excluding the volatile food and energy categories, core prices rose 2.6% in March from a year earlier, up from 2.5% in February. And last month, core prices rose a modest 0.2%, suggesting that rising gas prices haven't yet spread to many other categories. A big question for now is how long the oil and gas price shock lasts and whether it will lead to a broader, long-lasting inflation spike, similar to what happened in the spring of 2022 after Russia invaded Ukraine. For now, economists say that's unlikely. It's unlikely the U.S. will see a widespread increase similar to a few years ago when inflation topped 9%. Despite a tenuous ceasefire, little has changed in the Strait of Hormuz, a bottleneck where millions of barrels of oil typically pass daily. It's a painful in the near term, said Michael Pierce, the chief U.S. economist at Oxford Economics. It's going to get more painful in April when future gas prices increases will lift inflation higher. But Pierce said the impact may be shorter-lived than the pandemic. I think the conditions are much more like a short, sharp shock than what we saw in 2022. Pierce said that the impact could fade by later this year. I think the conditions are much more like a short, sharp shock than what we saw in 2022, he said. Last month, grocery prices slipped 0.2% and are up just 1.9% from a year earlier. Analysts do expect food prices to move higher in the coming months, as soaring diesel prices make shipping more expensive. Higher energy costs are contributing to rising production costs across the food supply chain and could put upward pressure on grocery prices going forward, said Andy Harrig, a vice president at the grocery trade group FMI, the Food Industry Association. As energy prices increase, the costs associated with producing and delivering food also rise. Clothing costs rose 1% in March from the previous month and are up 3.4% from a year earlier. Used car prices, however, fell 0.4% last month and are down 3.2% from a year earlier. The gas price shock stemming from the Iran war has shifted inflation's trajectory from a slow, gradual decline to a sharp increase further away from the Fed's 2% target. As a result, the central bank will almost certainly postpone any cut in interest rates for months. Many Fed officials will look past the increase in headline inflation, however, and focus on core prices, which are likely to rise more slowly. Gas prices are also highly visible, a cost that has outsized impacts on consumer confidence and political sentiment. High prices had angered American voters before the war, and the spike in prices for oil and everything that entails, from the pump to the grocery store, could make it more difficult for the president's party to hold on to seats in both the House and Senate in next year's midterm elections. Polling by the Associated Press, NORC Center for Public Affairs research last month found that about 6 in 10 Republicans are at least somewhat concerned about affording gas in the next few months. Gas prices averaged $4.15 a gallon nationwide Friday, up from $2.98 on the day before the war began, and nearly 40% up, according to Motor Club AAA. Inflation reached a peak of 9.1% in June of 2022 as COVID-19 snarled supply chains and several rounds of stimulus checks pushed up consumer demand. Prices soared for groceries, furniture, restaurant meals, and many other goods and services. U.S. inflation for March, gasoline spikes. This time, economists say the job market and consumer spending are weaker, and there are no large government stimulus checks being issued to spur demand. The unemployment rate is low at 4.3%, but companies are not scrambling to hire the way they were when the economy emerged from the pandemic, which led many firms to offer sharp pay increases to attract and keep workers. Rapid pay increases and solid income growth helped consumers weather the higher prices that resulted from the pandemic's supply chain disruptions and fueled spikes in demand that led many companies to raise prices further. That's where this really differs, is that we aren't seeing anywhere near the strength of demand, Alan Detmeister, an economist at UBS, said. In 2021 and 22, income growth was increasing really strongly. We aren't seeing that now, he added. Detmeister thinks the better comparison would be likely 1990 to 91, when higher oil and gas prices stemming from Iraq's invasion of Kuwait contributed to a recession, but did not lead to a jump in inflation, in part because of weaker consumer spending. The gas price spike's impact on inflation in some ways similar to President Donald Trump's tariffs, in that their effects will depend largely on the size and duration of the increase. Higher gas prices are tricky for the Fed because they can also slow growth by weighing on consumer spending, potentially causing layoffs. The Fed would typically cut its rate to encourage more spending if unemployment rises, while it raises rates to combat inflation. Christopher Rugabar has covered the Federal Reserve and the U.S. economy for AP for 16 years. He's a two-time finalist for the Gerald Loeb Award for Business Reporting. More AP developments now on the war with Iran. Major developments that AP is following: a tentative ceasefire is faltering as Israel pounds Beirut. Iran maintains its grip on the Strait of Hormuz, and truce talks remain uncertain. With both Tehran and Washington claiming victory and exerting pressure, talks on permanent deals could begin soon in Islamabad, with Vice President J.D. Vance said to lead the U.S. delegation. Israel-Lebanon negotiations are expected next week in Washington, according to a person familiar with the matter. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he had approved direct talks, while the Lebanese government did not immediately respond. Netanyahu said there is no ceasefire in Lebanon, and his country will keep striking Hezbollah. Although the Strait of Hormuz is closed, there were no reports of strikes inside Iran or attacks against Israel or neighboring Gulf Arab countries, leaving Lebanon as the only country where the conflict is still burning. The largest monthly jump in gas prices in six decades caused a sharp spike in inflation in March, creating major challenges for the inflation fighters at the Fed and heightening the political challenges of rising costs for the White House. This headline: Iranian ambassador to Tunisia says Iran is in armed negotiations with the U.S. by Gaia Ben Mabrek. We remain cautious and our hands remain on the trigger because we do not trust them, Ambassador Mir Massoud Hossianian told the Associated Press on Friday. He blamed the United States and Israel for reported ceasefire violations in the Iran war and said Iran is prepared to defend itself should there be not be satisfactory outcome in the next 2 weeks. He said Iran has been caught in a vicious cycle of negotiations, war, ceasefire, and other wars for years, adding, "We want to break this cycle." Hossianian said that the administration of the Strait of Hormuz after the war will inevitably differ from before. He added that Iran's right to enrich uranium is not negotiable, although the level of enrichment is, framing his country's nuclear program as necessary to a part of the future energy security. Kuwait says National Guard personnel wounded in Iranian aerial attacks. This is written by Noha El-Anaimi. Kuwait's army said Friday it had engaged with 7 Iranian drones over the last 24 hours. In a statement on the social platform X, it said the attacks targeted vital facilities affiliated with the National Guard. The post did not mention the number of injuries, adding only that there were in stable condition. The attacks resulted in significant material damage, the military said. Kuwait earlier had said it faced a drone attack Thursday night that it blamed on Iran and its militia allies in the region. Iran's IRGC denied launching an assault. Why Pakistan has emerged as a mediator between the U.S. and Iran. This is written by Munir Ahmed and E. Eduardo Castillo. It was initially seen as an unexpected mediator, but this week Pakistan has established itself as a key player in bringing Iran and the United States to the negotiating table. Now it's awaiting representatives from both countries to meet in Islamabad as the world watches to see whether the talks could lead to an end to the war. Since Washington and Tehran agreed to an initial 14-day ceasefire on Tuesday, Pakistan's Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif, Foreign Minister Ishaq Dar, and the powerful Army Field Marshal Asim Munir have been sharing messages about conversations with world leaders, highlighting their role as mediators. Islamabad isn't often called on to act as an intermediary in high-stakes diplomacy, but it stepped into this role because time for a number of other reasons, both because it has relatively good ties with both Washington and Tehran, and because it has a lot at stake in seeing that the war is resolved. Security forces move swiftly to lock down key parts of Islamabad. This is by Munir Ahmed. Commandos, police, and other security personnel set up barricades as dusk fell along routes linking the airport to the city, particularly those expected to be used by U.S. and Iranian delegations arriving for high-stakes talks. During their stay in Pakistan, the two delegations will also meet with Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif. The delegations arriving in Islamabad are scheduled to stay at a hotel where negotiations are expected to take place on Saturday. Ahead of the talks, Pakistan's Interior Ministry, Mohsin Naqvi, reviewed security arrangements for the delegations. In a statement, the Interior Ministry said, Islamabad's red zone would be completely sealed on Saturday, with entry restricted to authorized individuals. Multiple rounds of sirens heard across northern Israel. This written by Coral Said. Sirens signaling incoming fire from the militant Hezbollah group sounded in repeated waves across northern Israel on Friday, including in border communities and areas such as Nahiriya and Carmel. The Israeli military said about 30 projectiles were fired toward the area since morning. Trump's tenuous Iran exit plan isn't healing Republican rifts exposed by the war. This written by Stephen Sloan, Steve Peoples, and Meg Kennard. President Donald Trump's search for an off-ramp from the war with Iran is getting a bumpy inside his Republican Party. In the decades since Trump's America First movement rose to power by rejecting military intervention, his coalition has rarely been tested the way it is now. Trump's exit efforts, first through threats of annihilation, and then with a ceasefire that's proving precarious, are doing little to paper over tensions that have festered since the war began 6 weeks ago. Despite the growing criticism, Republican leaders in Congress were largely silent. Many were privately uncomfortable with Trump's threats on social media and were concerned about how the war would play out, especially in an election year. But with Congress on a recess for the opening 2 weeks of April, House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, and Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Republican of South Dakota, have offered little public reaction to Trump's moves. Israel banned Spain from Gaza Peace Monitoring Body by Noha El-Hanawy. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Friday that the Spanish government will be cast out of a U.S.-led coordination center in charge of maintaining peace in Gaza, citing Spain's alleged anti-Israel bias amid the war with Iran. Israel will not remain silent in the face of those who attack us. Spain has defamed our heroes, the soldiers of the IDF, the soldiers of the most moral army in the world, he said in a video statement. The Kiryat Gat-based Civil Military Coordination Center was established in October of 2025 as a multinational body charged with monitoring implementation of the peace agreement sponsored by Trump in Gaza. Those who attack the State of Israel instead of terrorist regimes will not be our partners regarding the future of the region, added Netanyahu. Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez has been one of the most outspoken critics of the war in Iran, which he denounced as illegal, reckless, and unjust. Our next AP News headline, Lebanon state-run news agency reports 13 state security officers killed, written by Isbel Debre. The NNA news agency reported that Israeli warplanes on Friday struck near a state security agency office in the southern town of Matnabatia, causing extensive damage at the government building. It said others were wounded in the strike and were being transferred to hospitals without specifying how many. At least 13 state security officers were killed, according to a statement from the agency. There was no immediate comment from the Israeli military on the specific strike. Its Arabic-language spokesperson, Avichai Adrei, claimed that Israel had hit more than 120 Hezbollah militant sites in the past 24 hours. Hezbollah has claimed a series of air and ground attacks against Israel in the last day after initially holding fire following news of the wider ceasefire deal in the Iran war. That deal brings relief to some in Iran, but Trump's threat still echoes. This is written by Amir Hussein Raji. Iranians have welcomed this fragile ceasefire deal after weeks of Israeli and American bombardment, but many fear the war is far from over. For some, there is also a sense of whiplash after U.S. President Donald Trump threatened to wipe out their civilization hours before he reversed course and agreed to an uneasy truce. The ceasefire that took effect Wednesday has brought relative quiet to the capital, Tehran, after more than a month of heavy strikes that targeted mainly government and security buildings, but also destroyed many homes. Everyone I've spoken with, it's given them a new life, a university student told the Associated Press in an audio note on WhatsApp, speaking on condition of anonymity over fears for his safety. AP spoke to half a dozen residents despite an ongoing nationwide internet shutdown imposed during mass protests before the war. Japan urges Israel and Hezbollah to reach a diplomatic settlement. Written by Mari Yamaguchi. Japan said it's deeply concerned about escalating Israeli attacks on Lebanon, urging all parties to immediately stop hostilities and comply with international law. Foreign Minister Tomitsutsu Motegi, in a statement Friday, expressed Japan's serious concern over Israel's ground operation against the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah, calling for respect for Lebanese sovereignty and territorial integrity. Vance says he believes negotiation with Iran will be positive. Written by Will Weissert. Boarding Air Force Two on his way to Pakistan, the vice president said, "We're looking forward to the negotiation. I think it's going to be positive. We'll, of course, see. He cited Trump saying if the Iranians are willing to negotiate in good faith, we're certainly willing to extend the open hand. But Vance also added if they're going to try and play us, then they're going to find that the negotiating team is not that receptive. Vance also said that Trump gave us some pretty clear guidelines on how talks should go, but didn't elaborate. The president, vice president did not take questions from reporters who were traveling with him. The next AP headline now, Melania Trump delivers statement at the White House denying knowledge of Jeffrey Epstein's crimes. The story is written by Colin Binkley and Will Weissert, and it's Dateline Washington. First Lady Melania Trump is denying ties to Jeffrey Epstein and knowledge of his sex crimes, saying Thursday that the stories are completely false and calling accusations that she was somehow involved smears about me. Reading an extraordinary statement at the White House, Melania Trump said she and her attorneys were fighting back against unfounded and baseless lies in regards to her connection to the late financier, a convicted sex offender who leveraged connections to the rich, powerful, and famous to recruit his victims and cover up his crimes. "The lies linking me with the disgraceful Jeffrey Epstein need to end today," she said. "The individuals lying about me are devoid of ethical standards, humility, and respect. I do not object to their ignorance, but rather I reject their mean-spirited attempts to defame my reputation." The seemingly out-of-the-blue message came as her husband, President Donald Trump, and his administration had finally seemed to move past more than a year of controversy surrounding Epstein, especially as the Iran war had become all-consuming in Washington. The First Lady's comments almost assuredly will serve to push the story back into the political spotlight, even as the president urged the public and media to move on from the case. Nick Clemons, a spokesperson for the First Lady, said, "The West Wing was aware beforehand that she was making a statement, but he deferred to the West Wing on whether the content of what Melania Trump planned to say was known. The White House press office did not respond to requests for comment." Calls for a congressional hearing for Epstein's victims. The First Lady spoke for about 5 minutes, reading her statement in the grand foyer, and then walked away without taking questions. She did not go into detail on the accusations against her, but said that they come from individuals and entities looking to cause damage to my good name. That's a quote. She added that they were financially and politically motivated. Melania Trump also called on Congress to hold a public hearing centered on survivors of Epstein's crimes, with a chance to testify before lawmakers and have their stories entered into the congressional record. "Each and every woman should have her day to tell her story in public if she wishes," she said. "Then and only then will we have the truth." Two of Epstein's accusers, Maria and Annie Farmer, said in a subsequent statement, "What we want is accountability, transparency, and justice." Former Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, a Georgia Republican and one-time fierce Trump supporter who resigned from Congress after a public falling out with the president, posted on X, "I am grateful to the First Lady for her brave statement today about Epstein and his victims." Democrats, meanwhile, jumped on Melania Trump's comments, saying they agreed with her call for a congressional hearing. In a social media post, Representative Robert Garcia, the top Democrat on the House Oversight Committee that is investigating Epstein, called on the Republican chair of the panel, Representative James Comer, to schedule a public hearing immediately. Representative Thomas Massie, Republican of Kentucky, who sponsored a bill prompting the release of millions of Epstein documents, turned attention back to the Justice Department, saying it's the Attorney General's job to bring in survivors for testimony. Massie, who has pressed for more arrests in the Epstein case, ended a social media report with a call to prosecute. Questions about Epstein's reach have loomed over the administration and divided Republicans, driving a wedge into Trump's MAGA base and Some pressed for government to release more files and prosecute figures linked to the financier. The issue has dogged Trump and fractured some of his alliances, including the one with Green. Trump dismissed the issue as a Democratic hoax, but later signed a bill to release files from Epstein's case. It was not clear what prompted the First Lady to revive the issue. She noted that several individuals and organizations have been trying to apologize for their lies about me, she said. Of the examples she cited, the most recent was in October. In that case, book publisher HarperCollins UK apologized to the First Lady and retracted passages from a book suggesting Epstein played a role in introducing her and Donald Trump. Melania Trump mentioned her husband several times in her comments. She said Epstein did not introduce her to Trump and that she met her future husband at a New York City party in 1998. Email to Maxwell was trivial. The First Lady brought Epstein back to the forefront months after the federal authorities released millions of pages of documents under the Epstein Files Transparency Act, the law enacted after months of political pressure that requires the government to open its files on the late financier and his confidant and one-time girlfriend, Ghislaine Maxwell. Lawmakers complained when the Justice Department made only a limited release last month, but officials said more time was needed to review additional documents that were discovered and to ensure no sensitive information about victims was released. Melania Trump said Thursday she was not friends with Epstein or Maxwell, but was in overlapping social circles in New York and Florida. She described an email reply she sent to Maxwell as casual correspondence without elaborating. My polite reply to her email doesn't amount to anything more than a trivial note, she said. Among the documents released by the Justice Department was a brief email from 2002 with the sender and recipient blacked out. It begins, "Dear G," and ends, "Love, Melania," and compliments the recipient on a magazine article about J.E. "I know you're very busy flying all over the world," it says. "How was Palm Beach? I cannot wait to go down. Give me a call when you're back in New York." That email was sent the same month that a New York Magazine article was published about Epstein, in which Trump called him a terrific guy. Among other documents released was an image from Epstein's home showing a series of photographs along a credenza and its drawers. In that image, inside a drawer, among other photos, was one of Trump alongside Epstein, Melania, Trump, and Maxwell. Epstein killed himself in 2019 while awaiting trial on sex trafficking charges in New York. Maxwell was convicted in 2021 of luring teenage girls to be sexually abused by Epstein and was sentenced to 20 years in prison. Associated Press writers Stephen Groves in Washington and Michael R. Sysak and Larry Neumeister in New York contributed to this report. Our next headline from the Associated Press is entitled "Artemis II's Grand Moon Finale is Almost Here," with a Pacific splashdown to cap NASA's lunar comeback. The story written by Marcia Dunn. The dateline is Houston. Their dramatic grand finale fast approaching, Artemis II's astronauts aimed for a splashdown in the Pacific to close out humanity's first voyage to the moon in more than half a century. The tension in mission control mounted as the miles melted away between the four returning astronauts and the Earth. All eyes were on the capsule's life-protecting heat shield that has to withstand thousands of degrees during the reentry. On the other, a test flight of the spacecraft in 2022 with no one on board, the shield's charred exterior came back looking as pockmarked as the moon. Commander Reid Weissman, pilot Victor Glover, Christina Koch, and Canada's Jeremy Hansen were on track to hit the atmosphere traveling a Mach 32 times the speed of sound, a blistering blur not seen since NASA's Apollo moonshots of the 1960s and 70s. They did not plan on taking manual control except in an emergency. Their Orion capsule, dubbed Integrity, is completely self-flying. Like so many others, lead flight director Jeff Radigan anticipated feeling some of the irrational fear that is human nature, especially during the 6 minutes of communication blackout preceding the opening of the parachutes. The recovery ship USS John P. Murtha awaited the crew's arrival, along with a squadron of military planes and helicopters. The last time NASA and the Defense Department teamed up for a lunar cruise reentry was Apollo 17 in 1972. Artemis II was projected to come screaming back at 34,965 feet per second, or 23,840 miles per hour. Not a record, but still mind-bogglingly fast before slowing to a 19-mile-per-hour splashdown. Artemis II's record flyby and lunar views. Launched from Florida April 1st, the astronauts racked up one win after another as they deftly navigated NASA's long-awaited lunar comeback, the first major step in establishing a sustainable moon base. Artemis II did not land on the moon or even orbit it, but it broke Apollo 13's distance record, making Wiseman and his crew the farthest that humans have ever journeyed from Earth when they reached 252,756 miles. Then, in the mission's most heart-tugging scene, the teary astronauts asked permission to name a pair of craters after their moonship and Wiseman's late wife, Carol. During the record-breaking flyby, they documented scenes of the lunar far side never seen before by the naked eye, and savored a total solar eclipse, courtesy of the cosmos thanks to their launch date. The eclipse, in particular, just blew all of us away, Glover said. Their sense of wonder and love awed everyone, as did their breathtaking pictures of the moon and Earth. The Artemis II crew channeled Apollo 8's first lunar explorers with EarthSet, showing our blue marble settings behind the gray moon. It was reminiscent of Apollo 8's famous Earthrise shot from 1968. It just makes you want to continue to go back, Radigan said on the eve of splashdown. It's the first of many trips, and we just need to continue on because there's so much more to learn about the moon. Their moonshot drew global attention as well as star power, earning props from President Trump, Canadian Prime Minister Matt Carney, Britain's King Charles III, Ryan Gosling, the star of the latest space flick Project Hail Mary, Scarlett Johansson of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and even Captain Kirk himself, with William Shatner of TV's original Star Trek. Artemis II was a test flight for future moon missions. Despite its rich scientific yield, the nearly 10-day flight was not without technical issues. Both the capsule's drinking water and propellant systems were hit with valve problems. In perhaps the most high-profile predicament, toilet trouble prevented the crew from using it for number one most of the trip, forcing them to resort to old-time bags and funnels. The astronauts shrugged it off. "We can't explore deeper unless we are doing a few things that are inconvenient," Koch said, "unless we're making a few sacrifices, unless we're taking a few risks, and those things are real worth it." Added Hansen, "You do a lot of testing on the ground, but your final test is when you get this hardware to space, and it's a doozy." Under the revamped Artemis program, next year's Artemis 3 will see astronauts practice docking their capsule with a lunar lander or two in orbit around Earth. Artemis 4 will attempt to land a crew of two near the moon's south pole in 2028. The Artemis II crew's allegiance was to those next Artemis crews, Wiseman said. "But we are really hopeful that we could just for a moment have the world pause and remember that this is a beautiful planet with a very special place in our universe, and we should all cherish what we've been gifted," he said. The Associated Press Health and Science Department received support from the Howard Hughes Medical Institute's Department of Science Education and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. The AP is solely responsible for all content. Our next headline from the Associated Press, in his first 100 days, Mamdani brings a unique star power to New York City governance. Story is written by Anthony Izaguirre. The dateline is New York. In his first 100 days in office, New York City Mayor Zohran Mamdani has governed with a star power unusual in politics. Crowds of supporters show up to his news conference. Basic municipal services have been infused with newfound excitement. Celebrities help him promote his agenda. In the process, he's been able to notch a few notable early wins, and he's reached a détente, at least for now, with President Donald Trump, a mercurial leader with an affinity for celebrities. But as Mamdani, a Democrat, marks an early milestone in his mayoralty, it remains to be seen whether he'll be able to leverage his fame into achieving the progressive policy proposals that propelled him to office. Though he's not without staunch critics, many of whom still view his past criticism of the police department and Israel as major problems, the mayor has been able to ease concerns among at least some of his skeptics. "It's early, but so far so good," said Jay Jacobs, chair of the State Democratic Party, who made waves for not endorsing Mamdani during the election. "We may not agree on everything philosophically, but he is getting the job done. Work as hard and as fast as New Yorkers." As the mayor approached his 100th day, long a benchmark for judging administration's opening vision, his team has moved to highlight the administration's commitment to the everyday responsibilities of the job. While much of those duties are typical for his local office, picking up trash, plowing snow, and filling potholes, the 34-year-old mayor has leaned on his knack for viral content creation to drive interest and awareness of government programs. As a storm bore down on the city this winter, Mamdani's calls on social media for more snow shovelers helped recruit thousands of new shovelers. Another social media video announcement from the mayor for this winter, this time about the city's emergency alert system, brought more than 50,000 new subscribers to the program in a week, his office said. Alongside New York Liberty star Natasha Cloud of the WNBA, Mamdani announced a bracket-style competition where people could vote on small repairs they wanted the mayor to come and personally fix in their neighborhoods. In a few weeks, more than 21,000 votes were cast. And to hype up his child care program for two-year-olds, Mamdani recruited Cardi B to help judge a jingle contest that will determine the program's theme song. "The challenge that we set for ourselves was to work as hard and as fast as New Yorkers do," Mamdani told reporters on his 99th day in office. The celebrity status, though, can also prompt backlash. During a bitter cold snap, his surprise appearance on The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon was seen by some as insensitive at a moment when the death toll in homeless New Yorkers was rapidly rising. "Too much styling and profiling," said Curtis Sliwa, a Republican who ran against Mamdani during last year's election, noting long-standing problems with street homelessness, a public housing and infrastructure issue. Still, Sliwa, who hammered Mamdani during the campaign but recently appeared in a comedy skit with him during a City Hall Press Corps annual roast, appeared to give Mamdani some credit, even if it came with a caveat. "We just had Eric Adams, a swagger man who'd party to the break of dawn, and now we have a guy who seems like he's got a normal working schedule," said Sliwa, referencing the city's previous mayor. "So have Zohran and the alternative. I think for a lot of people, even if they disagree with him, there's some stability." Budget woes. Mamdani has also trained his outsized audience on another routine reality of city governance, budgeting. Earlier this year, Mamdani held an unusually dour press conference at City Hall about a massive gap in the city budget, saying either the state would have to raise taxes on the wealthy or he would have to increase local property taxes to balance the budget. The public play from the mayor was widely seen as a strategy to pressure New York City or New York Governor Kathy Hochul into approving a millionaire's tax, a key priority for Mamdani and his base. Hochul, a moderate Democrat who is up for re-election this year, has strongly opposed such a measure. After the city council released a separate budget proposal that found different ways to close the gap, Mamdani slammed the plan and released a video calling out Council Speaker Julie Menin, resulting in some of his supporters attacking the speaker online. The city's budget woes, still unsolved, could prove a major hurdle for Mamdani as he pursues his agenda. Andrew Rain, president of the fiscally conservative Citizens Budget Commission, said Mamdani has an extra challenging budget process ahead of him, but the mayor's communications savvy could help him navigate the rough terrain. What we've seen is him bringing his newer strategies and his tools to communications, built in a very practical old-school problem, Rain said. When he uses his communication skills to get people more invested and to improve over functioning of the government and to help New York's Yorkers through trade-offs that have to be made, there's going to be a great win. Still a star among supporters. On the night of Mamdani's election party, hundreds packed the streets, some spontaneously waiting for a glimpse of the mayor-elect leaving the venue. Departing campaign aides were cheered by the name, and well after midnight, one attendee likened the street party to Beatlemania. "I feel like I'm at a presidential inauguration," said Mehdi Angioti, a 25-year-old tech consultant. "This is the first time in a while I've felt this hope." His star power has not appeared to wane since then among some factions. Outside City Hall, New Yorkers and tourists frequently stop for selfies, peering through the iron gates in search of the mayor. This week, on the mayor's 97th day in office, a massive crowd gathered in the lobby of the busy Bellevue Hospital in Manhattan, watching as Mamdani announced the city would start sending some people with serious medical illnesses to the hospital from the city's notorious Rikers Island jail. He entered to woos and applause from the large group, many appearing to be hospital staffers who held up cell phones to record videos of the mayor speaking. Dozens more watched along from a set of elevated walkways. One man, Ricardo Grandados, 67-year-old retiree, was on his way to take his son to a medical appointment, but stopped to see what all the hubbub was about. He appeared to be delighted to learn Mamdani was going to show up, saying he met Mamdani previously when the mayor was campaigning in Grandado's neighborhood. "I'm extremely fond of him. I think he's going to make a real difference," Grandados said. "He wants to find out who needs what, and he wants to help." AP writer Jake Offenhartz also contributed to the story. The next AP headline now: USPS is set to suspend pension contributions, seeks 4-cent stamp price hike. Written by Susan Hay. The U.S. Postal Service said Thursday it has informed federal budget officials it will temporarily suspend its employer contributions to federal employees' retirement system annuities, allowing it to keep making payroll, paying suppliers, and delivering the mail. The Postal Service also wants to increase postage rates, including raising the price of a first-class mail stamp, a forever stamp, from 78 cents to 82 cents. USPS officials filed notice Friday with regulators who still need to approve the changes. The step taken by the Postal Board of Governors to forego the pension payments is meant to preserve cash and liquidity due to the Postal Service's, quote, ongoing severe financial crisis, Postal Service Chief Financial Officer Luke Grossman said in an internal message to USPS employees. Officials have warned the Postal Service is on course to run out of cash around February of 2027. Despite the suspension of employer contributions effective Friday, current and future retirees will not be immediately impacted, Grossman said. The risk to the Postal Service and the American public from insufficient liquidity for postal operations dramatically outweighs any longer-term risk to the pension funds from not making the currently due payments, he said in the statement. USPS deferred payments in 2011 during another financial crisis. The Postal Service said it will continue transmitting employees' retirement contributions to the Federal Office of Personnel Management, along with the Thrift Savings Plan contributions, including employer automatic and matching funds, and will also maintain its employer contributions to Social Security. Brian Renfro, president of the National Association of Letter Carriers, said the temporary suspension of annuity payments is not ideal, but it doesn't immediately impact his members, who, he said, understand the Postal Service's financial challenges. Given a menu of operations and options, none of which are overall positive, they would certainly prefer the Postal Service making a move like this as opposed to something that immediately impacts them of a negative way, the service that we provide to the American people, Renfro said. 99% of career USPS employees are covered by the Federal Employees Retirement System. In a related matter, the Postal Regulatory Commission on Thursday granted the Postal Service a temporary multi-year waiver, allowing it to redirect billions of dollars in revenue previously earmarked for retiree benefits, providing some breathing room and flexibility to extend contingency plans and avoid running out of cash. Last month, Postmaster General David Steiner told the Associated Press and later a congressional committee that the 250-year-old service needs to have a decades-old $15 billion cap on borrowing raised to $34.5 billion so the independent agency can have access to more cash. That will buy us time to make the fixes we need to make, and we can sail on down the road, he told the AP. Steiner has called for other changes as well, including greater flexibility in how retirement funds are invested, changes to pension obligation methodology, and the authority for USPS to raise postage prices high enough to cover losses. Renfro said this latest move to pause employer contributions is the direct result of continued inaction by Congress to fix legislative restraints placed on the Postal Service. Keep U.S. Posted, an advocacy group representing consumers, catalogs, greeting card publishers, and others, has urged Congress to ensure any rate increase would be limited to once a year. The group also wants to ensure a six-day-a-week mail service remains, and the USPS regulators have greater control over any service changes. The Postal Service said the proposed price increase requested Thursday, which also affects postcards and international letters, will still make rates among the most affordable in the world. The Postal Service relies mostly on the sale of postage products and services to finance its operations. The Postal Service has seen annual volume plummet from about 220 billion pieces in 2006 to about 110 billion today as more people pay bills and communicate online. USPS's net losses for the 2025 fiscal year total $9 billion, even though totaling operating revenues increased by $916 million or 1.2%, due largely to its Ground Advantage shipping service. Net losses in fiscal year 2024 were $9.5 billion. Susan Hay, based in Connecticut, covers the state government, politics, state and federal public policy matters, and more for the Associated Press. She has worked for the AP since 2002. The next AP story is headlined AP Exclusive. Trump administration admits a glaring error in its New York health fraud accusations. The story written by Ali Swenson. And the dateline is New York. President Donald Trump's administration this week acknowledged it made a significant error in figures it used to help justify a fraud probe into New York's Medicaid program, a glaring mistake that undercuts a federal campaign to tackle waste, mostly in Democratic-led states. The error, which the administration admitted first to the Associated Press, prompted health analysts to question how many of the Republican administration's sweeping anti-fraud efforts around the country were based on faulty findings. One of a few mischaracterizations it made about New York's Medicaid program, it also reflected a common criticism that's been made of Trump's second administration, that it tends to attack first and confirm the facts later. These numbers could have been cleared up in a phone call, so it's really slapdash, said Fiscal Policy Institute senior health policy advisor Michael Kinnikum, whose recent analysis called attention to Trump's inaccurate claim. The mistake appeared in comments made last month by Dr. Mehmet Oz, the administrator of the Centers for Medical and Medicaid Services, in a social media video and in a letter to New York's Democratic governor announcing the fraud investigation. Oz claimed that New York's Medicaid program last year provided some 5 million people with personal care services, which assist people in need with basic activities like bathing, grooming, and meal preparation. That would add up to a nearly three-fourths of the state's 6.8 million Medicaid enrollees. That level of utilization is unheard of, Oz said in the video, adding his post that the New York needs to come clean about its Medicaid program, a quote. But the real number of New Yorkers who used those services last year was about 450,000, or between 6 and 7% of total enrollees, CMS spokesman Chris Krepek told the AP this week. He said the agency misidentified New York's approach to applying billing codes and had since refined its methodology. CMS is committed to ensuring its analyses fully reflect state-specific billing practices and will continue to work closely with New York to validate extra and data, that is, and strengthen program integrity oversight, he said in an emailed statement. Krepek said the probe was ongoing as the administration still has concerns with New York's oversight of personal care services and the Medicaid program and is reviewing the state's response to last month's letter. CMS has raised other flags about New York's program, including that it spends more per beneficiary and per resident than the average state, has a high personal care spending level, and employs so many personal care aides that the job category is now the largest in the state. Health analysts say the state's high spending reflected both a high cost for services in New York and a policy choice to provide robust at-home care. Cadence Aquiveva, a senior public information officer for the New York Department of Health, called Oz's initial mischaracterizations a targeted attempt to obscure the facts. New York State remains committed to protecting and preserving a vital Medicaid program that delivers high-quality services to New Yorkers who depend on them, she said. In a statement, a spokesperson for Governor Kathy Hochul said the initial claim by CMS was patently false, and we're glad they now admit it. Governor Hochul has been clear that New York has zero tolerance for waste, fraud, and abuse in Medicaid or any other state programs, and will continue her efforts to root out bad actors, protect taxpayer dollars, and safeguard the critical programs that New Yorkers rely on, a spokeswoman Nicolette Simmons said. New York is part of a larger crackdown. The Trump administration's investigation into New York comes as it has similarly approached at least four other states, including California, Florida, Maine, and Minnesota, with investigations into potential health care fraud. The anti-fraud effort appears to be expanding as voters in the upcoming midterm election say they're concerned about affordability. Trump last month signed an executive order to create an anti-fraud task force across federal benefit programs led by Vice President Vance. As part of that project, Vance announced the administration would temporarily halt $243 million in Medicaid funding to Minnesota over fraud concerns, a move over which the state has since sued. Kinnikum, the analyst with expertise in New York's Medicaid program, said He's concerned that the Trump administration's adversarial approach to targeting fraud in some states politicizes a conversation that should be a team effort. We want to think collaboratively among all the stakeholders in the program about how we can actually fix it, Kinnikin said. We don't want to have fraud be this political football. In his video, Oz made at least two other claims about New York that Medicaid advocates and beneficiaries say distorted the facts. In one instance, he said the state recently made its screening for personal care eligibility more lenient by allowing problems like being easily distracted to qualify for a personal care assistant. Rebecca Antar, director of the Health Law Unit at the Legal Aid Society, said the opposite was true, that the state, in a rule change that went into effect last September, and instead made its program requirements more stringent. She said being easily distracted doesn't appear anywhere among them. Krepek said the administrator was referring to whether New York's standard for personal care service was sufficiently rigorous. When standards are overly permissive, it risks diverting resources away from individuals with the highest levels of need and placing long-term pressure on the sustainability of the Medicaid program, he said. Oz in the video also referred to personal care services as something that our families would normally do for us, like carrying groceries. Kathleen Downs, a 33-year-old who has quadriplegic cerebral palsy and uses personal care services in New York's Nassau County, said she was offended by the notion that all Medicaid beneficiaries have family members who are willing and able to help. They all do not, she said. This has been our reading of the Associated Press news for Friday, the 10th of April. My name is Al Freeman.